Hello again, this is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And once again, it is time for another one of our gritty reboot series, where the cast and crew of Ask an Atheist go back and view a topic that we haven't touched in some time, back from the early days of the show, which are sort of foundational to the purpose of the show, I suppose. Joining me is Becky, how are you?
Great, Sam.
And Dan, how are you?
I'm excellent.
And I couldn't think of a better group of people to talk about something that is actually pretty important to just about anybody I talk to within atheism or humanism or, you know, Satanism or whatever. You know, any of those non-theistic things going around. And that's creationism versus evolution. And, well, specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about creation. And the notes I have, and I think Becky kind of ran with it, is the thing I actually wrote down, not being really serious, was creationism, stupid or dumb.
I love it, and I kind of have sort of, yeah, stupid or dumb, right? You're kind of thinking like, okay, well, obviously, both of them. But I kind of think of dumb as the sort of uninformed and stupid as the sort of willful digging in, saying, no, all you evolutionists defy God and you're going to burn in hell, right? So you kind of have two sides of those coins, and that's a lot of folks that I've met that are really skeptical of evolution or straight up say it didn't happen or it isn't happening or it's some plot by public school teachers to take over the world. I have no idea.
Right.
How's that going, by the way?
Not very well. But, you know, I kind of find them falling into these two categories, either the willful digging in or the just uninformed. Like, no, that couldn't have happened. That couldn't have been how it actually happened, right?
It's more sort of like a circumstantial ignorance versus a deliberate ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of like, I don't know, maybe this is a little bit too personally revealing, but you know when you're really little and the first time you find out how babies are made and you're like, no, that can't be, right? So, you know, you kind of have that. I think a younger family member of mine, you know, kind of heard the lecture and then said, who thought that up, right?
Right.
So I kind of get a lot of those in terms of the evolution. Who thought that could possibly be real?
The biological grossness of coitus really detracts from the stork narrative, I think.
You know. Right.
Well, so we're basically have a snapshot of where creationism is today, I think is what you're going for here.
Yeah, and I think the first time we did this about 6 years ago.
Yeah,
we were looking specifically at the Kitzmiller trial, which was somewhat recent. But we've got some.
It was
distance.
Very recent. It was in the month of the first time we did this episode.
And we've got some distance from that now. And is it really going on? I mean, are people still trying to teach intelligent design in schools?
Let's define creationism first. Creationism is the idea that the world and everything you see, et cetera, was specifically in Christian creationism, created as you see it now by an overarching caretaker, actively interested deity. And when, you know, back in the days when we didn't have science the way we had it now, we're literally just trying to make sense of the world with the tools we had available. And those tools weren't that fantastic, but we still had the kind of brains that we've got now. This is the kind of stories that came up with us. This is literally a Bronze Age myth. This is from a very long time ago, specifically the Christian concept of the creation of the world. And then that was the reigning champion of what was for, you know, at least in the Western world for a couple thousand years until science got reestablished and caught up with things and started learning a lot more stuff. And through observation, better intellectual and physical tools came up with better models for the way the world works, plate tectonics, and specifically, as we're talking about now, evolution and the origin of biological species.
Definitely. And, you know, you do still see this in a potent way in very fervent believers. And
Right. What
I observe is that whether it's stupid or dumb, most of the arguments for creationism really fall into categories of logical fallacies. And so a really good place to ground an examination of a creationist belief or a creationist assertion is to look and see whether, hey, are what you're saying, is what you're saying falling into a logical fallacy?
Right.
So, I mean, the first thing you look at is, you know, religion says God created all of these things. And when you grow up in a religion, you have two things in favor of creationism at that point, which is fear and indoctrination. Indoctrination is that's just kind of like I take it as a given because that's what I know. And then the fear is if I disbelieve creationism and I'm inclined to believe in evolution or understand that,
then God will become angry with you.
There's more than just God will become angry with me. This is going against my entire church and upbringing.
Right.
And that kind of leads us to the logical fallacy argument from authority.
And this is the big one. I mean, the whole concept of Christian creation is, by definition, an argument from authority. Their book is supposedly the word of God. God is the ultimate authority over everything ever, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, the entire basis of the argument is, in fact, an argument from authority. Their argument not only is from authority, their argument is authority.
Exactly. There are, as it might be somewhat surprising, though, there's other people that are in authority on creationism. It could be your pastor. It could be a priest. It could be even a scientist, strangely enough. So one of the funny things that I came across, and it's been up for a while, and it's linked to on the Discovery Institute, proponent of intelligent design, which is, as we learn in the Kitzmiller trial, just creationism masquerading with a different label. Look at all these scientists who disbelieve evolution, and then there's a huge list of scientists that have signed the dissent from Darwin statement.
There were approximately 690, is that correct?
Yeah, somewhere around 700 of, you know, and they could be scientists that could have degrees in any number of different scientific disciplines, some of whom might not have biological evolution as one of their degrees. And Dan, you had a contrasting group of scientists, didn't you?
Yeah, there actually is a counter to the Dissent from Darwin project and list. It's called Project Steve, and this is a list of only scientists whose name is Steve or Stephen. Who have signed a list saying that that they accept the evidence of evolution. Currently, it's 1,406 scientists named Steve. Now, this is just, of course, the Steves that are scientists that accept evolution who have heard of this project and decided to get involved and put their names on it. So we can assume that there's probably a lot more Steves out there that are scientists that accept evolution. And Steve is a common name in the United States, but not the most common name. So if we were to start something like the John Project, scientists named John that accept evolution.
I have a feeling that if you called something the John Project, it would have a very different focus.
We might end up with a different focus.
Yeah.
The purpose of the Steve Project, though, is to demonstrate that, you know, there are a very, very small percentage of persons claiming to be scientists who reject evolution.
Yeah, and another problem that we face with these projects, specifically the descent from Darwinism thing, is that the people who are signing this aren't necessarily the scientists involved with this sort of research. You have structural engineers, material engineers, who are very much experts in their own right, but whose knowledge doesn't really overlap with the kind of knowledge that is required to really understand what we understand about evolution and speciation at this point, which you have to understand, especially in this situation, that speciation, because of our understanding of genetics, which is one of the tools that allows us to understand what evolution is to begin with in a modern context, everything is changing right now just because we are learning so much of what we got wrong from genetics.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that we can really point out about a difference between a scientific ideal and a scriptural ideal. Scriptural ideals don't change. They say, this is the fact and believe it, you know, believe it. It's faith. It's your duty under, you know, under the Lord to believe this thing.
Right.
In science, we change things. So one of the examples I like to make about evolution when people say, well, Darwin's ideas have been proven wrong. Now, some of them have been proven wrong, but that doesn't mean we throw out the whole idea. There was once a belief that the Earth was flat.
Yeah, there was.
That was accepted by seekers of truth at the time. We later found that the Earth is, in fact, a sphere, and that was truer than a flat Earth. But later we find that the Earth isn't actually a sphere. It's what we call an obloid spheroid, which is sort of tomato-shaped. It's fatter around the equator than it is from pole to pole. And that is truer than it being a sphere, and the sphere is truer than it being flat. And now we've launched satellites and found that the Earth is actually a much more complicated shape than just an obloid spheroid. Does that
still
mean,
smoother than a cue ball, though?
It's still smoother than a cue ball. Yes. Yeah.
From an engineering perspective, it's a sphere.
It's very close to a sphere. But our understanding that it's not a sphere doesn't mean that we go, oh, well, the flat Earth was right.
Yeah.
It means that we go, well, the sphere wasn't as right as our current understanding.
And even if a sphere, I think, is good enough for most things. But the interesting fact is that when we talk about why the Earth isn't a sphere, it leads to interesting discussions and interesting questions about gravitation and rotation and orbital mechanics and stuff like that, that you wouldn't have a place to talk about otherwise. And I think it's important, while we're talking about this descent from Darwinism thing, it's important to read it. It's a very short statement. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutations and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination for the evidence of Darwinian theory should be encouraged. Now, on its own, that's not a terrible statement, especially since evolution has significantly moved on from Darwinian theory.
Whatever, right.
If that ever meant anything in the first place in the confines of, you know, biology. But what they don't tell you is that the people behind this and the people signing this have this huge raft of other beliefs and other ideas that don't come from the scientific method, that have been completely and continually and repeatedly discredited. But they hide that away when they want to show, make it look like the scientists are discredited. The reason they're asking for, skepticism and attention isn't out of some scientific basis. It's entirely religious. It's entirely ideological.
It's one of the things that makes it really insidious, that you have something that sounds like it could be somewhat scientific to loop in folks that maybe don't have as discerning of an eye there. I also love that it says that it can't be explained merely by natural selection. No, because there's more than just natural selection in terms of a mechanism of evolution. I mean, there's sexual selection. Yeah, that's how you get, the sexiest mate with the biggest antlers
and kin selection and reciprocal altruism. And that there are numerous things that go into it other than simply natural selection.
Right.
One could probably categorize them under sort of like chapters of natural selection, but generally in evolutionary science, we look at them separately as if they were separate tools in the same box causing these changes.
So this is from where creationism comes and where all this argument starts, but it isn't just arguments from authority that generate this sort of creationism argument, correct, Becky?
No, not at all. I think one of the biggest things that you find is the straw man argument. And straw man is usually something where you say, hey, I'm in a debate with you and I misrepresent my opponent's argument for the purpose of making it easier to attack. I also see, in terms of creationists, you might have a misunderstanding of someone's argument, and that makes it easier to come to a false conclusion that evolution isn't true. So that would be the dumb side. The stupid side is like, no, I'm going to specifically make you look like a Darwinist is a Satanist. And something ridiculous like that.
Right.
So there's some ones that we see all the time that's, we've already said, hey, one piece of Darwinian evolution was falsified. So therefore, evolution didn't happen and it was all God. And he said, no, there's more than just those little pieces. We've also talked about the evolution's just a theory and my creationist and intelligent design theory is just as likely. And that's misrepresenting or misunderstanding what scientific theory means. Dan, you want to take us through ever so briefly what scientific theory means and how it's different from a literary theory?
Yes. So a scientific theory is not it's not a guess. It's not an idea. It's something that has been tested again and again and again by different parties with different interests, by different methods, and found that the theory currently explains all of the available evidence. It's not just some, crazy idea that somebody thought up. It is something that has been through the absolute rigors of the scientific community and had every test thrown at it to break it if possible. When something becomes a theory, it's very, very rare that we ever renege on that rather than add to it, like we did with evolution by a natural selection.
So another straw man argument you have is, no one's ever observed evolution. It's unobservable. And the scientific theory of evolution says that you can never observe it. So, Dan?
Well, not true. I even know that one.
Observing evolution, we have the approximately 40,000 or so year history of both dogs and agriculture, where we have selected little change by little change to go from a wolf or a mustard plant to numerous strains of broccolis and kales.
Wait, we turned
Brussels
a wolf
sprouts.
Into broccoli? I want to see
I'm
that.
Getting that. Let me finish. So we take this mustard plant and this wolf, and over thousands of years, we've turned our mustard plant into broccoli, kale, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, all of the cruciferous
ones, right?
Vegetables. Yes, the brassica. All of which are currently considered to be the same species and can actually cross-pollinate and create, well, less useful crops. But I digress. And we've turned this wolf, this once, you know, pack-hunting, free-ranging timber wolf, into numerous kinds of dogs, everywhere from a Great Dane and a Mastiff to a Chihuahua and a Dachshund. They all have the same lineage tracing back to wolves.
I'm also pretty sure that we've, don't chapter and verse me on this, as may end up in the show notes, but I believe we have seen bacteria develop the ability to digest vinyl or nylon on at least two separate occasions.
Yeah.
And so what happens in this case is that we see some mutation arise, some genetic shuffling that allows something to do something that it couldn't do before.
Mm-hmm.
And then the definition of what creationists are looking for as evidence for evolution suddenly changes.
Right. They'll scoot the goalpost.
Yeah. They'll just move the goalpost, which is another big part of this, where it'll stop being about mutations and start being about, oh, for example, a dog giving birth to a cat.
Or broccoli.
And where
I like to turn my dogs into broccoli.
Yeah. Were that to happen, that would actually not only undo, that would undo the current models of creationism, but it would also undo evolution. That would be that would be an outlier. That would change everything.
Yeah. sorry, I'm hung up on broccoli dogs.
Broccoli dogs.
Broccoli dog farts would have to be the worst.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So you have that. Why can't you have a dog give birth to kittens or something like that, or broccoli for that matter? Because that's that misrepresentation of what evolution actually is.
Right.
That that it's not a change in one organism, and it's not from one parent to one kid that poof you have a completely different species. Right.
Right.
That
it's
gradual change over time.
Gradual change, generation by generation, little change by little change. We do see occasional instances of brown-eyed people giving birth to blue-eyed offspring, and you know, genetic tests will show that they are the child of these two brown-eyed people. Now, that's a very uncommon mutation, but it's a mutation that occurs, and it's something that we can observe, and it's something that's going to be passed on by this blue-eyed person. While blue eyes tend to be a recessive trait, if they met another blue-eyed person, they're likely to have a blue-eyed offspring.
So another really common one is because creationism encompasses both how living organisms came to be and how the Earth itself came to be, the non-living parts of Earth, sometimes you'll have, the theory of evolution posits how life started, so it's just another creation belief.
No, it doesn't. That's a whole other class of ideas called abiogenesis, for which there are numerous, numerous hypotheses. But none of them have been proven because, you know, this the origin of life happened on Earth so long ago. And how do you get a fossil from a non-living thing? You cannot find a transitional form between a non-living chemical compound and a living reproducing compound. Of the theories, I think my favorite is RNA World, where we found that RNA, one of the nucleic acids that we use in our cells that every living thing uses. Some RNA strands can act as both coded information for proteins and also act as proteins themselves, as enzymes that catalyze the reactions that create those same proteins. So if you could have an early on chemical soup where you have numerous different strands of RNA, it is plausible that some of these strands of RNA act as the enzymes that allow the other strands of RNA to be replicated, which would be a pretty good example of the origin of life, going from a non-living chemical to a self-replicating thing capable of changes in encoded information.
But that in and of itself is something that has some support, but is not evolution, nor is it part of the theory of evolution.
Right. No, it's not. It's part of abiogenesis. It's just one of the many ideas. Some of the other ideas about abiogenesis or biogenesis on Earth are panspermia, that perhaps living organisms, very basic, simple living organisms, came on comets from other places where life maybe started differently and struck the Earth and found a home here. I think that's a cool one. I don't think it's particularly likely, but it is neat.
So can we end with the last and most perhaps exhausting straw man argument about evolution?
Which one?
If we came from monkeys, why are there still monkeys?
Right.
Oh, dear.
I know that one.
You want to take it away?
Yeah, because we didn't come from monkeys. Monkeys and people came from a previous ancestor that gave
rise
both species to... emerged from. It's as simple as that. And also we're monkeys. I mean, it is that simple.
Yeah. I like to use an example here with the history of our country as immigrants. If Caucasian Americans came from Europeans, then why are there still Europeans?
Yeah. Or if rocks give rise to statues, why are there still rocks?
Yeah. where in the reality of the immigrant hypothesis there, modern Europeans and modern Americans, are a little bit different, but we descend from a common ancestor that was different from both of us, but similar.
I do like using the statue one because it leaves an opening for them to go, you know, I know exactly where they're going when I start talking about an artist and a creator.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's the thing that I do.
Yeah, so that's
a little bit of trolling there.
just a tiny bit.
Has Ngatwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngatwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an Ngatwe Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's
more than basic. My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait, not sacrificing children, that's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn. And we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month, we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVsTheMartians.com.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at SeattleAtheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
What's next on our list, Becky?
So one thing that you see particularly in schools or pushed in schools is this middle ground fallacy. So that's a logical fallacy that says that a compromise between two extremes must be the truth. First of all, I would argue that evolution isn't all that extreme, right? And so it's not like you have on one line creationism on one side that says the Earth is 5,000 years old and evolutionists on the other side of things and there's a continuum. There really isn't. Yes, there are different kinds of creationists, some that think that the Earth is 5,000 or 6,000 years old, some that, oh, Sam, who did we run into that was a creationist that said they were much more moderate? They accepted that the Earth was at least 20,000 years old?
Oh, yeah. This is an early creationism kind of questionnaire debate thing that we went to.
Hosted by Seattle Skeptics.
Yeah, it was Seattle Skeptics in like 2009, 2010. Just literally like months before the show started. And it was somebody who considered himself a moderate because he believed that the Earth was only 20,000 years old rather than 5. And, 20 million. 20 million was certainly well off, to say nothing.
Versus the 4.56 billion.
Yeah, that we know basically to be true at this point.
So what you see here, though, is this middle ground fallacy. That much more reasonable creation scientist, as he, creationist, I will say, as he billed himself, thought that he could be the most reasonable because he was striking a middle ground between what he thought were two extremes. So the thing is, though, that halfway between something that's true and something that's not true is still something that's not true. Halfway between truth and a lie is still a lie. So you get into intelligent design. Let's relabel creationism. It looks more reasonable. Yes, we accept that evolution happened, but it was all because of an intelligent designer who put it in motion. Well, there's still not evidence for that. There's sufficient evidence and overwhelming evidence that evolution happened.
Right.
Right? There's evidence that falsifies that God created the Earth as it is right now 5,600 years ago. So the middle ground still doesn't say it's more true than either of those two ends. Another thing I wanted to address here, though, also is when it first really started ticking in my mind, because you guys know that I grew up, moderately religious, observant Jew, but with a very kind of radical egalitarian sort of bent on it. And it was eighth grade reading Inherit the Wind. Now, you guys read Inherit the Wind or saw the movie?
Mm-hmm. I saw the play.
There's that great line that's how long is a day? And, if God created the heavens and the earth, how long could that first day have been? Well, maybe all of the age of the earth or of the universe that happened before living things came into being, maybe that was during that first day before we could know that the sun and the moon were placed in the heavens. And you could kind of try and reconcile that around there. But the truth is that you try and reconcile the fossil records and evidence of evolution with this compromise, and there's not evidence to say that there was a creator. And so it's still trying to strike that middle ground without evidence to support you. And it doesn't make it any truer.
No.
Appeal to emotion is an interesting one. That's the one we're talking about, yes?
That middle ground fallacy.
Oh, still a middle ground fallacy?
Yeah, but it relates to appeal to emotion because that middle ground makes you feel good, like you've reached a good, middle ground. I'm most reasonable. I'm trying to get along. I'm trying to be a peacekeeper. So, but what were you thinking of in terms of appeal to emotion?
Well, it is an appeal to emotion because, yeah, doesn't it feel good? And particularly that you have this get out clause, basically, that makes everybody feel just kind of okay, but isn't really satisfying to anybody. I'm not a big fan of appeals to emotion because most of the time they make a lot of assumptions that everybody feels the same way about stuff. You know, for example, you know, isn't it nice that we all live under this watchful panopticon of the soul that God provides? And my answer to that is no, I find that terrifying. I think that's a bad idea. I think it's a terrible idea because that just turns your God into like the weirdest absent parent ever. Who would never, you know, who would never live up to the standards of parenting required by any state in the union.
Let's report God to CPS.
Right. It's that bad. And it just like the things that they talk about, well, isn't your emotional, you know, doesn't this touch your emotional core in some way? As somebody who wasn't raised in that particular way, no, it doesn't really appeal to me at all. And appeals to emotion and appeals to sort of the public good or, you know, public morality or something like that. Just when you're trying to use all of these things to modify the truth, that's a problem. That continues to be a problem. It doesn't make the truth go away. Like, we can't wish the truth out of existence.
I think one of the things that I find most troubling about the idea of the emotional appeal there that you should feel good that there's this being out there that loves and cares for you,
yeah,
is that I'm a person who looks at biological systems, and when I look at that, if you're going to tell me that this being is either capable of preventing childhood bone cancer or implicit in implementing childhood bone cancer, right, you're not describing the kind of being that I would want watching over me at all.
Right. I mean, what is intercessionary prayer for then? I mean, because if this is all part of some sort of holy plan,
right,
that we're following, that requires not only kind of that requires things like harlequin ichthyosis to exist, but also a world affairs scenario that requires the death of significant quantities of children.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing intercessory prayer, this is another subject entirely. You're basically saying, I don't like your plan, God, make a different plan. That's what it is. That's what it always is.
Yeah.
And that makes it strange to me when you take this sort of, the fact that you have a process for basically saying, I don't like your plan, God, make a different plan. And then you try to tell me how wonderful it all is when it comes to the, you know, emergence of intelligent life on Earth. You lose me. You just really lose me. And this emotional argument just fails to work. What's next on our list, Becky?
Well, I would like to talk about another emotional argument that doesn't work.
Okay, very quickly.
Yeah, and that's wouldn't the natural world be so sad and meaningless if we assumed that it weren't created?
This is just a subset of what we were just talking about. It's really just the same thing from a different direction. Rather than coming at it from a God direction and saying, look, isn't it nice that God made this? It's, look at this natural world. Isn't it great that God made it? It's the same argument, just in reverse.
Yeah. So we also got the misplaced burden of proof.
I like this one.
Yeah, that's where, you know, really, it's incumbent upon the person making that positive claim to provide evidence for that claim. So, you know, in the face of, you can't prove that God didn't create the heavens and the earth, it's really hard because, no, one can't prove that something didn't happen like that. I mean, that's the, you can't prove there's not, you know, Bertrand Russell's teapot orbiting the earth. You can't prove that the flying spaghetti monster isn't, you know, watching out for us with his noodly appendages.
I think we can prove pretty unequivocally that the creation stories presented in the Bible are false, because
yeah,
they go against the evidence.
This is why I say, from an atheistic perspective, from a knowledge perspective, I'm an atheist. From a belief, or I'm sorry, I'm agnostic. From a belief perspective, I'm an atheist, except that I believe it is provable that the stories of some human religions are false.
Right.
For example, the creation, you know, the world creation myths in most religions are provably false.
Certainly. Or in the Quran, it's presented that mountains are the pillars of the earth that keep everything in place, when in fact they are the result of tectonic plates moving around. They're almost the opposite of what they're stated to be.
Precisely. And, you know, that means if the God that you're talking about in the Bible exists, or in the Quran exists, that entity is not perfectly described in the holy book that you are offering as perfect proof that that thing exists. And it becomes sort of a self-disproving tautology that, you know, it's just, yeah, it's a silly
Your
argument.
Your ideas are bad, yeah, and you should feel bad.
Yeah, go for something else here. please try a different track. And the other thing is, the fact that we can't prove it isn't meaningful.
No,
not at all.
Yeah.
One thing that I also really like and that I find with creationists is that personal incredulity fallacy, where I don't have a complete understanding of it. And so I'm going to go with the simple, you know, nice understanding. Yeah, I don't understand how car engines work. And so I'm just going to think that it's elves running on a bicycle. Right. I mean, that's kind of what you're getting at right here. And for that, I want to give the shout out to a lot of really good resources. One, public school teachers, two, lots of different podcasters. But if you're looking to
not so much a shout out as a personal high five.
A personal high five, yeah. Yes. Or a pleading to please send your kids to public school with good biology teachers, I guess. But I want to actually to have that more complete understanding. There's two really good websites. One of them is the NOVA Evolution Lab. And then one of them is University of California, Berkeley, Understanding Evolution. And there's a lot of things that would be misunderstandings that would help fill in a lot of those gaps. And they present it in a really awesome, nice way. And if you want to go all the way down to preschool level, you got Grandmother Fish.
That's true.
So it's tough when you are, there's so much knowledge in the world. There's so much knowledge to consume and digest and synthesize that you can't be knowledgeable in everything. And so you need some of those easily digestible resources to then help fill in your gaps. And now you don't have a God of the gaps where, you know, God is the creator. You filled in your own personal gaps and understand that creationism isn't really something that makes sense at all.
So what's next on our list?
Well, you touched on it a little bit, and it's the argument from popularity.
I like this one.
Well, I think...
Do you like this one? Many people like this
many
argument.
Many people like this argument. And
well, then I guess I should like this argument.
No, it's an argument that's on its way out. I mean, it's an interesting situation where people say, well, most people in the United States don't believe in evolution. How can it possibly be true if most people don't believe in it? And then, so it creates basically these loci of truth, where if I fly over to Europe and I say, and I talk to this guy and I say, hey, you know, where we are right now, most people believe in evolution. Then apparently evolution is obviously true, yes?
Right there, yeah.
Yeah, and it just shoots this whole argument under the water. It's it's an argument that has a temper, that as evolution continues to be understood by the general populace of the United States, it's one that's just going to go away as time goes on. And it just seems it really is feeling like that evolution is being understood by more and more people in the United States, despite attempts in government and other places to prevent its knowledge from being understood. Because, you know, internet, YouTube, videos, right, that sort of thing.
I think the places where it still does blossom is in societies and in communities where you have restriction on social interaction. So these could be highly religious homeschool circles. These could be places where children are not permitted to use the internet or smartphones. But I think, as you said, you know, yeah, YouTube, web pages, that like kids will find how to access the internet and how to access knowledge.
Right. And it, as it becomes easier and easier to access those things, it's going to be harder and harder to hide. And this also sort of occults a different argument in that scenario, which is everybody around us believes that evolution is false, therefore evolution is false. It's a popular argument. But everybody outside of our little farm is of the devil.
Naturally.
And so popularity arguments quickly turn into arguments from anti-authority, I guess.
Mm.
diabolic arguments, if you will. And that's so this, I almost always find arguments from popularity to be a transitional argument,
ooh,
if you will, into something else. It's basically an introduction into some other larger argument. Because especially in the United States, where you have these dueling philosophies that should cancel each other out and don't, which is, we live in a Christian substrate, therefore America should be a theological nation, versus we are constantly being persecuted as Christians in the United States. And it just, this alone cannot stand because of the psychology involved of the people who are making this argument. This argument just cannot work, even in their own minds.
I do want to say that there are little things that still are indicative of very entrenched creationist beliefs. you have, you know, some schools that you'll have teachers that will, you know, be science teachers that will insist that God created the world. You'll have people who work for the Discovery Institute here in our, you know, just yeah, north backyard, of us in yeah. Seattle, who will run for public office. You know, we had someone who lost his election, but it was David DeWolf, who was a law professor at Gonzaga University. And I should say the Catholic Church, you know, who runs Gonzaga University as a Jesuit school, doesn't, you know, disbelieve in evolution at all. But this particular law professor was running for state Supreme Court and would be making, you know, possibly decisions on school cases.
Right.
It still pops up in different places. And so it's still something that's on the radar, and it's still something that we should keep on our radar and that we should continue to try and educate and understand that people come from these perspectives. And hey, you know what? When you understand something a little bit better, maybe you'll be less inclined to believe either out of stupidity or dumbness.
Mm.
Okay, our last one is black or white or dichotomous thinking, and you're going to have to follow me through this one. I don't quite get it.
Yeah, that's a logical fallacy. We touched on it earlier that, hey, because something has been disproven, it must be all God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, just because we found out that Mendeleev wasn't exactly, you know, precise with every single thing about genetics, not everything comes down to a Punnett square, it doesn't mean that all evolution is false and God created things in 6 days, rested on the seventh. Just because we found out that the Earth isn't exactly spheroid doesn't mean that it's flat. Just because we understand that that certain genetic expressions can be turned on and off or activated or non-activated doesn't mean that genes don't exist and God had a plan for us to be as we are right now. I mean, that's that black and white thinking. Just because one thing is false or incorrect doesn't mean that it has to be what you originally came with. There's a plethora of options out there for explanations.
I don't think I could have summarized that any better.
Very good. I think the important thing to walk away with when you are an atheist, a humanist, a Christian who believes in, you know, what the scientific facts are, who has no problem being religious, but also understanding evolution and cosmogenesis and all that stuff. I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is that all of the stuff that we talk about, the theories, the arguments, these are foundational for us. These define why we believe what we believe. The data provided to us, the data we are using in order to build these arguments, define our argument, fully define our argument. It's all there. It's all on the table. It's all available for perusal. On the other side, on the other side of this argument, the people who are saying the Christian methodology, you know, the Christian mythology is all correct, when they pick up and they use these scientific theories to have these arguments with us, they're not foundational. They are merely knives and spears and guns and weapons to use against these arguments, and they keep what the actual foundational things that define their actual arguments, they keep that off the table. They don't talk about those arguments. When you look at all of these sort of logical fallacies that Becky has set aside, or all of the other arguments that they talk about why evolution isn't true, why this planet was created in 7 days, why it's 4,000 years old, or 20,000 years old, or 20 million years old, or why the galaxy is a lie, they'll use scientific argument in order to make those scientific, in order to have that debate and be treated with respect in the scientific square. But the fact of the matter is, the truth of it, the reason why they're making these arguments is not on the table, is not perusable, and is not on the level. It's not fair. They're not being honest or of good faith in their arguments in this respect. And that's something that we have to keep in mind, that when you defeat someone in a debate, when you get around their argument, when you show them to be obviously false, they don't care. They don't care at all, because the whole point isn't to make that argument win. The whole point is to get you or somebody else to believe in a Christian myth that isn't under discussion. All he has to do is poke enough holes in your argument in order to say, oh yeah, I've got this other answer, which has nothing to do with science. It makes you feel good as long as you give me 10% of everything you own every year. And that's it. Is the whole point is that even in arguments like these, and this is something that I think we get wrong a lot of the time, is that we treat the people on the other side of this debate as equals. And they're not. They're not equals to us. Their arguments are lesser. They are not fair. They are not of good faith. And they think that even if every one of their arguments is defeated, it doesn't matter. They're just going to come up with a whole host of new ones. That's why when intelligent design fell through the courts and failed, they came up with teach the controversy. And when teach the controversy fails, as it is now failing, they'll just come up with something else. And when that fails, something else. And when that fails, something else.
Deceit on deceit on deceit. It's deceptive turtles.
And that's the end of this podcast. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can voicemail us at 844-753-7842. That's 844-SKEPTIC. You can visit us on Twitter on askanatheistwa. This episode was pre-recorded. Thank you guys very much. See you next week.